Our choir awakens in us the full range of emotion. Sometimes their voices feel like an embrace, like a shoulder to lean on. And other times, like today, their singing urges us to praise the life. Every week, we gather here in this sanctuary for peace, pause, and inspiration. Protected for a time from the harsh world outside, we try to fulfill, on a small scale, a vision of the world as it could be, and we try to be the people that we wish to be. We are not perfect in our efforts. We fail. We disappoint each other. And then we begin again in love. Here we welcome the stranger and practice engaging with people who are new to us. We welcome families composed in a variety of ways and declare all love to be good. We meet people from different countries, diverse social backgrounds, and we honor them all. Here we incubate the values that do not thrive so easily out there. We nurture dignity, compassion, and interdependence. We respect each other's religious and political differences. We teach our children to think critically and to use their gifts to bless the world. Here, we gratefully meet others who despair in the cruelties of the world. And finding them here, we feel relief that we are not alone. In our coming together, we heal. None of these things we do perfectly. We fail. We disappoint each other. And then we begin again in love. But Sunday always ends, and Monday always comes. And we have to go back out there. Back into the world of cutthroat competition and divisive partisanship. We go back out there and we are wounded once more by racism and homophobia. Now, even when we are not directly affected by these things, we are still wounded simply by living in the culture that supports these injustices. Our hearts ache as we see more young soldiers and civilians killed in war. And even when we don't know anybody in the military or citizens in these countries, we are still wounded simply by witnessing these events. The list of ways in which people are hurt by public policy and commercial practices goes on and on. And if we are very honest with ourselves, we know that part of our heartache comes from the knowledge that we ourselves hurt others, and we commit injustice, and we are involved with institutions that do so. So then when Sunday comes back around, we bring all those experiences that we've had in the outside world back into this sanctuary, and those experiences demand a response. Our inner voice tells us what our first response should be. It is to be compassion, to suffer with, to provide a place here where healing happens. But after we have given and received care and comfort, the voice, that inner voice, continues to speak, calling us to turn, calling us to face the source of harm. And when we do turn, we see corruption and deceit and greed and hatred and willful ignorance and arrogance, and sometimes we see ourselves in those things. We cannot deny that those things are the cause of our suffering. We realize that the brokenness, that our brokenness, is mirrored in the institutional brokenness of the world. And then we are moved to speak prophetically. How could we remain silent? In 1963, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was sitting in a jail cell in Birmingham, and he wrote a letter on little scraps of paper torn from the pages of magazines and newspapers. The letter from Birmingham was a response to 8 white Alabama pastors who urged Dr. King and his followers to quiet down their voice of protest. He responded, "We will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the hateful words and actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence of the good." We cooperate with the forces of life and the forces of good by declaring that the values we cultivate here in our spiritual community are missing from the world out there, and that suffering is the result. This is the prophetic voice of the religious institution. The prophetic voice is both a voice of critical judgment and the voice of hope. It is the voice of no. It calls powerful institutions to task when they use their power illegitimately or arbitrarily. It calls commerce and government to account for its failed policies, and it demands that the most vulnerable be protected. The prophetic voice must also be a voice of yes. It must be the voice of hope. It is the voice that says, another way is possible. We have seen it. We have seen people rise to their very best. We have seen the beloved community where love overcomes division. It is the turning that is this prophetic voice of hope. So the more we cultivate our shared values within this spiritual community, the more we are compelled to say no to injustice and yes to the good. When you and I said yes to Unitarian Universalism, we stepped into a centuries-old living tradition of dissent and prophetic voice, a tradition that has been doing exactly what I have been describing, creating a community of healing and compassion, and in that community, nurturing values, then with those values in hand, turning to the social and political establishment to speak with critical judgment. When you and I said yes to Unitarian Universalism, we entered into an existing covenant. A covenant with those who came before us to resist oppression in all its human forms. From Michael Servetus, who was burned at the stake for challenging the doctrine of the Trinity, to Theodore Parker, who had to keep a pistol at his desk because people opposed his efforts to repeal the fugitive slave law, and the Reverend James Reeb, who was beaten to death while marching with Dr. King in Selma. This doesn't mean that the struggle to know exactly how and when to take a public stand comes easily for us. This knowing continues to trudge along at a fitful and uneasy pace. Alongside these prominent and proud moments in our history are moments of lamentable silence. Times when we did not embrace our power or our responsibility. Moments when we abandoned our role as critic of the political and commercial establishment and absented ourselves from engagement with social and cultural issues. And yet, when an issue like Proposition 1 showed itself in our community, impacting our family members and our friends, it was impossible not to speak. And speak we did, with phone banking and letter writing and the installation of the banners out in front of our building. All kinds of feelings have been stirred up by those big blue banners. And it has tapped into some confusion about whether it is even legally permissible for our church to take a public position on a political issue. A recent submission to the last word section of the Gazette says, "How come, with all the hollering about separation of church and state, a local church, that's us, puts out an oversized sign that clearly states its opinion on an issue, and no one says a word? Yet pastors can get into trouble if they get too political in the pulpit." This person's comments reflect a misunderstanding of the First Amendment and the IRS rules. Neither prohibits us from taking the actions we took. The First Amendment actually protects the right of churches to advocate for their values in the public square. What is prohibited is the state establishing a preference of one religion over the other. And pastors can get into trouble, but only when they violate the federal tax law prohibiting campaign intervention by all nonprofits. Houses of worship and charitable groups cannot participate in or intervene in any political campaign on behalf of or in opposition to any candidate for public office. That's straight from the IRS. The tax law does explicitly allow us to take a position on public policy and ballot measures, such as Proposition 1. So issues, not candidates. This was our first collective action to take our values into the public square. It will not be our last. Because as long as we can sustain an environment here where we can nurture spiritual values, we will always have the strength to speak out. This environment that I'm talking about is our church, and it needs to maintain a healthy independence from the world of politics and commerce. Only in this way can we maintain the distance needed for us to be that critical voice. That's why, even if we could endorse candidates, we wouldn't. We don't want to be in anybody's pocket. We need to maintain our separateness. In another passage from Dr. King's letter, he says, "Perhaps I have once again been too optimistic. Is organized religion just too inextricably bound to the status quo to save our nation or the world? So often the church is an arch defender of the status quo, and far from being disturbed by the presence of the church, the power structure in the average community is consoled by the church's silent and even often vocal sanction of the way things are." One of the reasons that Unitarian Universalists fight so hard to maintain the separation of church and state is so that we can maintain the independence we need to be a credible critic of our times. Unfortunately, sometimes we use the separation of church and state as a reason to keep our distance from the public square. The Williamsburg UUs will be presented again with the opportunity to take our values into the public square. And when new issues come up, there will be situations where support for a proposed initiative is not unanimous in our congregation. Unanimity should not necessarily be expected in our democratic polity. For example, the congregational vote on the marriage amendment was not 100%. If we had insisted on a unanimous vote, then we would have been left with individual action. And that would have been okay. But when we believe so strongly in the values that we see missing out there in the public realm, we want to advocate for those values in the most effective way we can, through collective action. So for the sake of furthering this community's values, we accept the fact that occasionally each of us may find himself or herself in the minority. The congregational vote was more than just a symbolic gesture. It mobilized people to action, to make phone calls, to go door to door, raise money, attend events, wear buttons, wear those things. To work the polls, to talk to their neighbors. But beyond the practical advantage of collective action, it is a declaration of who we are and what we stand for. We created more than an effective team of workers. We created a community identity and declared it to the world. This is an extraordinary contribution to the greater good, and one that many churches just cannot do. So how do we figure out who we are as a church and what we stand for? We come to this shared identity by engaging in open dialogue about our values. Unlike more traditional religions, Unitarian Universalist theology does not begin with the authority of the Holy Word, the Bible, the Quran, the Torah. Our theology begins with the authority of the lived experience of human beings. Our values do not come through the scriptures. Our values come to us by what we learn from living and by listening to the experiences of others, especially others who are seemingly different from us. We take those stories, we make meaning out of them, we articulate the values based on those experiences, and then flesh becomes word instead of the other way around. During the past 3 months, we have heard moving personal stories from this pulpit, which have become part of our community of dialogue. They have become part of our critical awareness of the world. And through conversation with each other, we come to find out what is of mutual concern. And we focus on what unites us rather than what separates us. This is how we uncover the ties that bind. This is how we discover the beloved community that already exists, but is sometimes very hard to see. In another part of Dr. King's letter, he describes driving through the South, looking at the beautiful churches with their lofty spires pointing toward heaven, and he writes, "Over and over I have found myself asking, what kind of people worship there? Who is their God? Where were they when Governor Wallace gave a clarion call for hatred and defiance? Where were their voices of support when bruised and battered Negro men and women decided to rise up from the dark dungeons of complacency to the bright hills of creative protest? There was a time when the church was very powerful. In those days, the church was not merely a thermometer that recorded the ideas and principles of popular opinion. It was a thermostat that transformed the morals of the society. Things are different now. So often the contemporary church is a weak, ineffectual voice with an uncertain sound. Let no one drive past our lovely building asking, where were their voices of no when the state called for hatred? Where were their voices of yes when oppressed men and women began to rise? May it be so.